abandoned book bags and purses and textbooks. He snapped each item close up, then at a distance with a little yellow, tinted evidence marker to record its placement in relation to the rest of the scene. Another officer examined blood spatter patterns. A third and a fourth were pointing to a spot in the upper right corner of the ceiling. "Captain," one of them said, "looks like we've got a video."
"Where's the recorder?"
The officer shrugged.
"Principal's office?"
"Go find out," Patrick said. He walked down the main aisle of the cafeteria. It looked, at first glance, like a science fiction movie. Everyone had been in the middle of eating and chatting and joking around with friends, and then, in the blink of an eye, all the humans were abducted by aliens, leaving only the artifacts behind. What would an anthropologist say about the student body of Sterling High, based on the Wonder Bread sandwiches scarred by only one bite, the tub of Cherry Bomb lip gloss with a fingerprint still skimming the surface, the salt and pepper composition notebooks filled with study sheets on Aztec civilization, and margin notes about the current one?
"I love Zach S. Mr. Kiefer is a Nazi."
Patrick's knee bumped one of the tables, and a loose handful of grapes scattered like gasps. One bounced against the shoulder of a boy slumped over his binder, his blood soaking into the college-ruled paper. The boy's hand still held tight to his eyeglasses.
Had he been cleaning them when Peter Houghton arrived for his rampage?
Had he taken them off because he didn't want to see? Patrick stepped over the bodies of two girls who lay sprawled on the floor like mirror twins, their miniskirts hiked high on their thighs, and their eyes still open. Walking into the kitchen area, he surveyed the troughs of graying peas and carrots and the runny slop of chicken pot pie, the explosion of salt and pepper packets that dotted the floor like confetti. The shiny metallic helmets of the Yoplait yogurts, strawberry and mixed berry and key lime and peach, which were still miraculously aligned in four neat rows near the cash register, an unflinching, tiny army. One worn plastic tray, with a dish of Jell-O and a napkin on it, waiting to be served the rest of the meal. Suddenly, Patrick heard a noise. Could he have been wrong? Could they all have missed a second shooter? Could his team be canvassing the school for survivors, and still be at risk themselves? He drew his gun and crept into the bowels of the kitchen, past racks with monstrous cans of tomato sauce and green beans and processed nacho cheese, past massive rolls of plastic wrap and Cisco tin foil, to the refrigerated room where meats and produce were stored. Patrick kicked open the door, and cold air spilled over his legs.
"Freeze!"
he yelled, and for the briefest moment, before he remembered everything else, he nearly smiled. A middle-aged Latina lunch lady, wearing a hairnet that crawled over her forehead like a spider web, inched out from behind a rack of prepackaged bags of salad mix. Her hands were raised. She was shivering.
"No me tire," she sobbed.
Patrick lowered his weapon and took off his jacket, sliding it over the woman's shoulders.
"It's over,"
he soothed, although he knew this was not really true. For him, for Peter Houghton, for all of Sterling, it was only just beginning.
"Let me get this straight, Mrs. Calloway," Alex said. "You are charged with driving recklessly and causing serious bodily injury while reaching down to aid a fish?"
The defendant, a 54-year-old woman sporting a bad perm and an even worse pantsuit, nodded.
"That's correct, Your Honor."
Alex leaned her elbows on the bench.
"I've got to hear this."
The woman looked at her attorney.
"Mrs. Calloway was coming home from the pet store with a silver arowana," the lawyer said.
"That's a $55 tropical fish, Judge," the defendant interjected.
"The plastic bag rolled off the passenger seat and popped. Mrs. Calloway reached down for the fish, and that's when..."
the unfortunate incident occurred. By unfortunate incident, Alex clarified, looking at her file, you mean hitting a pedestrian.
Yes, Your Honor.
Alex turned to the defendant.
How's the fish?
Mrs. Calloway smiled.
Wonderful, she said. I named it Crash.
From the corner of her eye, Alex saw a bailiff enter the courtroom and whisper to the clerk, who looked at Alex and nodded. He scrawled something on a piece of paper, and the bailiff walked it up to the bench.
Shots fired at Sterling High, she read.
Alex went still as stone.
Josie. Court's adjourned, she whispered, and then she ran.
John Eberhard gritted his teeth and concentrated on moving just one more inch forward. He couldn't see, with all the blood running down his face, and his left side was completely useless. He couldn't hear, either. His ears still rang with the blast of the gun. Still, he had managed to crawl from the upstairs hallway, where Peter Houghton had shot him, into an art supply room. He thought about the practices where Coach made them skate from goal line to goal line, faster and then faster still, until the players were gasping for breath and spitting onto the ice. He thought about how, when you felt you had nothing left to give, you'd find just one iota more. He dragged himself another foot, digging his elbow against the floor. When John reached the metal shelving that held clay and paint and beads and wire, he tried to push himself upright, but a blinding pain speared his head. Minutes later, or was it hours, he regained consciousness. He didn't know if it was safe to check outside the closet yet. He was flat on his back, and something cold was drifting across his face. Wind, coming through a crack in the seal of the window. A window. John thought of Courtney Ignacio, how she'd been sitting across from him at the cafeteria table when the glass wall behind her burst. How suddenly there had been a flower blooming in the middle of her chest, bright as a poppy. He thought of how 100 screams, all at once, had braided into a rope of sound. He remembered teachers poking their heads out of their classrooms like gophers, and the looks on their faces when they heard the shots. John pulled himself up on the shelves, one-handed, fighting the black buzz that told him he was going to faint again. By the time he was upright, leaning against the metal frame, he was shuddering. His vision was so blurred that when he took a can of paint and hurled it, he had to choose between two windows. The glass shattered. Jackknifed on the ledge, he could see fire trucks and ambulances, reporters and parents pushing at police tape, clusters of sobbing students, broken bodies spaced like railroad ties on the snow. EMTs bringing out more of them. Help, John Eberhard tried to scream, but he couldn't form the word. He couldn't form any words. Not look, not stop, not even his own name. Hey, someone called. There's a kid up there. Sobbing by now, John tried to wave, but his arm wouldn't work. People were starting to point. Stay put, a fireman yelled, and John tried to nod, but his body no longer belonged to him, and before he realized what had happened, that small movement pitched him out the window to land on the concrete 2 stories below. Diana Levin, who had left her job as an assistant attorney general in Boston 2 years ago to join a department that was a little kinder and gentler, walked into the Sterling High gym and stopped beside the body of a boy who had fallen directly on the 3-point line after being shot in the neck. The shoes of the crime scene techs squeaked on the shellacked floor as they took photographs and picked up shell casings, zipping them into plastic evidence bags. Directing them was Patrick Ducharme. Diana looked around at the sheer volume of evidence, clothing, guns, Blood spatter, spent rounds, dropped book bags, lost sneakers. And realized that she wasn't the only one with a massive job ahead of her.
What do you know so far?
We think it's a sole shooter. He's in custody, Patrick said. We don't know for sure whether anyone else was involved. The building's secure.
How many dead?
10 confirmed.
Diana nodded. Wounded?
Don't know yet. We've got every ambulance in northern New Hampshire here.
What can I do?
Patrick turned to her. Put on a show and get rid of the cameras. She started to walk off, but Patrick grabbed her arm. You want me to talk to him?
The shooter?
Patrick nodded.
It may be the only chance we have to get him before he has a lawyer. If you think you can get away from here, do it.
Diana hurried out of the gymnasium and downstairs, careful to skirt the work of the policemen and the medics. The minute she walked outside, the media attached themselves to her, their questions stinging like bees. How many victims? What are the names of the dead? Who is the shooter? Why? Diana took a deep breath and smoothed her dark hair back from her face. This was her least favorite part of the job, being the spokeswoman on camera. Although more vans would arrive as the day went on, right now it was only local New Hampshire media. Affiliates were CBS and ABC and Fox. She might as well enjoy the hometown advantage while she could.
My name is Diana Levin, and I'm with the Attorney General's office. We can't release any information now because there's an investigation still pending, but we promise to give you details as soon as we can. What I can tell you right now is that this morning there was a school shooting at Sterling High. It's unclear as to who the perpetrator or perpetrators were. One person has been remanded into custody. There are no formal charges yet.
A reporter pushed her way to the front of the pack.
How many kids are dead?
We don't have that information yet.
How many were hit?
We don't have that information yet, Diana repeated. We'll keep you posted.
When are charges going to be filed? Another journalist shouted. What can you tell the parents who want to know if their kids are okay?
Diana pressed her mouth into a firm line and prepared to run the gauntlet.
Thank you very much, she said.
Not an answer at all. Lacey had to park 6 blocks away from the school. That's how crowded it had become. She took off at a dead run, holding the blankets that the local radio announcers had urged people to bring for the shock victims. I've already lost one son, she thought. I can't lose another. The last conversation she had had with Peter had been an argument. It was before he went to bed the previous night, before she'd been called into a delivery.
I asked you to take out the trash, she had said. Yesterday. Don't you hear me when I talk to you, Peter?
Peter had glanced up at her over his computer screen.
What?
What if that turned out to be the final exchange between them? Nothing Lacey had seen in nursing school or in her work at a hospital prepared her for the sight she faced when she turned the corner. She processed it in pieces. Shattered glass, fire engines, smoke, blood, sobbing, sirens. She dropped the blankets near an ambulance and swam into a sea of confusion, bobbing along with the other parents in the hope that she might catch her lost child drifting before being overwhelmed by the tide. There were children running across the muddy courtyard. None of them had coats on. Lacey watched one lucky mother find her daughter, and she scanned the crowd wildly, looking for Peter, aware that she didn't even know what he was wearing today. Snippets of sound floated toward her.
Didn't see him. Mr. McCabe got shot. Haven't found her yet. I thought I'd never... Lost my cell phone when... Peter Houghton was...
Lacey spun around, her eyes focusing on the girl who was speaking, the one who'd been reunited with her mother.
Excuse me,
Lacey said. My son. I'm trying to find him. I heard you mention his name. Peter Houghton?
The girl's eyes rounded, and she sidled closer to her mother.
He's the one who's shooting.
Everything around Lacey slowed. The pulse of the ambulances, the pace of the running students, the round sounds that fell from the lips of this girl. Maybe she had misheard. She glanced up at the girl again and immediately wished she hadn't. The girl was sobbing. Over her shoulder, her mother stared at Lacey with horror, and then carefully pivoted to shield her daughter from view. As if Lacey were a basilisk, as if her very stare could turn you to stone.
There must be some mistake. Please let there be a mistake, she thought,
even as she looked around at the carnage and felt Peter's name swell like a sob in her throat. Woodenly, she approached the closest policeman.
I'm looking for my son, Lacey said. Lady, you're not the only one. We're doing our best to...
Lacey took a deep breath, aware that from this moment on, everything would be different.
His name, she said, is Peter Houghton.
Alex's high heel twisted in a crack in the sidewalk, and she went down hard on one knee. Struggling upright again, she grabbed at the arm of a mother who was running past her.
The names of the wounded, where are they?
Posted at the hockey rink.
Alex hurried across the street, which had been blocked off to cars and was now a triage area for the medical personnel loading students into ambulances. When her shoes slowed her down, they were designed for an indoor courthouse, not running around outside, she reached down and stepped out of them, running in her stockings down the wet pavement. The hockey rink, which was shared by both the Sterling High School team and the college players, was a 5-minute walk from the school. Alex reached it in 2 minutes and found herself being pushed forward by a throng of parents, all determined to see the handwritten lists that had been taped to the door panels, lists of the children who'd been taken to area hospitals. There was no indication of how badly they'd been hurt, or worse. Alex read the first 3 names. Whitaker Obermeyer, Caitlin Harvey, Matthew Royston.
Matt?
No,
a woman beside her said. She was petite, with the dark, darting eyes of a bird and a froth of red hair.
No,
she repeated, but this time the tears had already begun. Alex stared at her, unable to offer comfort, out of fear that grief might be contagious. She was suddenly shoved hard from the left and found herself now standing in front of the list of wounded who'd been taken to Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Alexis, Emma,
Horuka, Min,
Price, Brady, Cormier, Josephine. Alex would have fallen if not for the press of anxious parents on either side of her.
Excuse me,
she murmured, giving up her place to another frantic mother. She struggled through the growing crowd.
Excuse me,
Alex said again, words that were no longer polite discourse, but a plea for absolution.
Captain, a desk sergeant said as Patrick walked into the station, and he slid his eyes toward the woman who was waiting across the room, coiled tight with purpose.
That's her.
Patrick turned. Peter Houghton's mother was tiny and looked nothing like her son. She had a pile of dark curls twisted on top of her head and secured with a pen. She wore scrubs and a pair of Merrell clogs. He wondered, briefly, if she was a doctor. He thought about the irony of that.
First, do no harm.
She didn't look like a person who'd created a monster, although Patrick realized she might have been caught just as unaware by her son's actions as the rest of the community.
Mrs. Houghton?
I want to see my son.
Unfortunately, you can't, Patrick replied. He's being held in custody.
He has a lawyer.
Your son is 17, legally an adult. That means that Peter's going to have to invoke his right to an attorney himself.
But he might not know,
she said, her voice breaking. He might not know that's what he needs to do. Patrick knew that, in a different way, this woman was a victim of her son's actions, too. He had interrogated enough parents of minors to know that the last thing you ever wanted to do was burn a bridge. Ma'am, we're doing our best to understand what happened today, and honestly, I hope you'll be willing to talk to me later, to help me figure out what Peter was thinking. He hesitated, and then added, I'm very sorry. He let himself into the inner sanctum of the police station with his keys and jogged up the stairs to the booking room with its adjacent lockup. Peter Houghton sat on the floor with his back to the bars, rocking slowly. Peter, Patrick said, you all right? Slowly, the boy turned his head. He stared at Patrick. You remember me? Peter nodded. How'd you like a cup of coffee or something? A hesitation, and then Peter nodded again. Patrick summoned the sergeant to open Peter's cell and led him to the kitchen. He'd already arranged to have a camcorder running, so that if it came down to it, he could get Peter's verbal consent to his rights on tape, and then get him to talk. Inside, he invited Peter to take a seat at the scarred table, and he poured two cups of coffee. He didn't ask Peter how he liked it, just added sugar and milk and set it in front of the boy. Patrick sat down, too. He hadn't gotten a good look at the boy before. Adrenaline will do that to your vision. But now he stared. Peter Houghton was slight, pale, with wire-rimmed glasses and freckles. One of his front teeth was crooked, and his Adam's apple looked fist-sized. His knuckles were knotty and chapped. He was crying quietly, and it might have been enough to engender sympathy had he not been wearing a T-shirt splattered with the blood of other students. "You feel all right, Peter?" Patrick asked. "You hungry?" The boy shook his head. "Can I get you anything else?" Peter put his head down on the table. "I want my mom," he whispered. Patrick looked at the part in the boy's hair. Had he brushed it that morning, thinking, today's the day I'm going to kill 10 students? I'd like to talk about what happened today. Would you be willing to do that? Peter didn't answer. If you explain it to me, Patrick urged, maybe I can explain it to everyone else. Peter lifted his face, crying in earnest now. Patrick knew this wasn't going to go anywhere. He sighed, pushing away from the table. All right, he said. Let's go. Patrick led Peter back to the holding cell and watched him curl up on the floor on his side, facing the cement wall. He knelt behind the boy, one last-ditch attempt. Help me help you, he said. But Peter just shook his head and continued to cry. It wasn't until Patrick had stepped out of the cell and turned the key in the lock that he heard Peter speak again. They started it, he whispered. Dr. Gunther Frankenstein had worked as the state medical examiner for 6 years, which was exactly how long he'd held the Mr. Universe title in the early 1970s before he traded in his barbells for a scalpel. Or, as he liked to put it, went from building bodies to taking them apart. His muscles were still formidable, and visible enough beneath his jacket to stop the onslaught of any monster jokes incurred by his last name. Patrick liked Gunther. How could you not admire a guy who could lift 3 times his body weight, and yet also know, just by eyeballing a liver, roughly how many grams it would weigh? Every now and then, Patrick and Gunther would grab a few beers together,
consuming enough alcohol for the former bodybuilder to tell him stories of women offering to oil him up before a competition, or good anecdotes about Arnold before he became political. Today, however, Patrick and Gunther didn't joke around, and they didn't talk about the past. They were overwhelmed by the present as they moved silently through the halls, cataloging the dead. Patrick met Gunther at the school after his abortive interview with Peter Houghton. The prosecutor had only shrugged when Patrick told her Peter hadn't been willing or able to talk.
"We have hundreds of witnesses saying he killed 10 people," Diana had said. "Arrest him."
Gunther crouched down beside the body of the sixth casualty. She had been shot in the girls' bathroom, and her body was sprawled face down in front of the sinks. Patrick turned to the principal, Arthur McAllister, who'd agreed to accompany them for identification.
"Caitlin Harvey," the principal said, his voice haunted. "Special needs kid. Sweet girl."
Gunther and Patrick looked at each other. The principal didn't just identify the bodies. He also gave a little one- or two-sentence eulogy each time. Patrick supposed that the man couldn't help himself. Unlike Patrick and Gunther, he wasn't used to dealing with tragedy in the course of his normal occupation. Patrick had tried to retrace Peter's footsteps from the front hallway to the cafeteria, victims one and two, Courtney Ignacio and Maddie Shaw, to the stairwell outside it, victim three, Whit Obermeyer, to the boys' bathroom, victim four, Topher McPhee, through another hallway, victim five, Grace Murtaugh, into the girls' bathroom, victim six, Caitlin Harvey. Now, as he led the team upstairs, he took a left into the first classroom, trailing a smeared line of blood to a spot near the chalkboard where the body of the only adult victim lay, and beside him, a young man with his hand pressed tight over the bullet wound in the man's belly.
"Ben," McAllister said, "what are you still doing here?"
Patrick turned to the boy.
"You're not an EMT?" No.
"You told me you were an EMT."
"I said I'd had medical training."
"Ben's an Eagle Scout," the principal said.
"I couldn't leave, Mr. McCabe. I applied pressure, and it's working. See? The blood stopped."
Gunther gently removed the boy's bloody hand from his teacher's stomach.
"That's because he's gone, son."
Ben's face crumpled.
"But I...
"You did the best you could," Gunther assured him.
Patrick turned to the principal.
"Why don't you take Ben outside? Maybe let one of the doctors take a look at him?"
"Shock," he mouthed over the boy's head. As they left the classroom, Ben grasped the principal's sleeve, leaving a bright red handprint behind.
"Jesus,"
Patrick said, running a hand down his face. Gunther stood up.
"Come on, let's just get this over with."
They walked toward the gymnasium, where Gunther certified the deaths of two more students, a black boy and a white one, and then into the locker room, where Patrick had ultimately cornered Peter Houghton. Gunther examined the body of the boy Patrick had seen earlier, the kid in the hockey jersey, whose cap had been blown off his head by a bullet. Meanwhile, Patrick walked into the abutting shower room and glanced out the window. The reporters were still there, but most of the wounded had been dealt with. There was only one waiting ambulance, instead of seven. It had started to rain. By the next morning, the bloodstains on the pavement outside the school would be pale. This day might never have happened.
"This is interesting," Gunther said.
Patrick closed the window against the weather.
"Why? Is he deader than the rest of them?"
"Yeah.
He's the only victim that's been shot twice. Once in the gut, once in the head."
Gunther looked at him.
"How many guns did you find on the shooter?"
"One in his hand, one on the floor here.
two in his backpack. Nothing like a little backup plan.
Tell me about it, Patrick said. Can you tell which bullet was fired first?
No. My educated guess, though, would be the one in the belly, since it was the slug to the brain that killed him.
Gunther knelt beside the body.
Maybe he hated this kid most of all.
The door of the locker room flew open, revealing a street cop soaked by the sudden downpour. Captain, he said, we just found the makings of another pipe bomb in Peter Houghton's car.
When Josie was younger, Alex had a recurring nightmare about being on a plane when it went into a nosedive. She could feel the spin of gravity, the pressure that held her back in her chair. She saw purses and coats and carry-on luggage burst out of the overhead compartments to fall into the aisle.
I have to get my cell phone, Alex had thought,
intent on leaving Josie a message on the answering machine that she could carry around forever. Digital proof that Alex loved her and was thinking of her at the end. But even after Alex had grabbed her phone from her purse and turned it on, it took too long. She'd hit the ground when the phone was still searching for a signal. She'd awaken, shaking and sweaty, even as she dismissed the dream. She rarely traveled apart from Josie. She certainly didn't take flights for her job. She'd throw back the covers and head to the bathroom and splash water on her face. But it didn't stop her from thinking, I was too late.
Now, as she sat in the quiet, dark of a hospital room, where her daughter was sleeping off the effects of a sedative given to her by the admitting doctor, Alex felt the same way. This is what Alex had managed to learn. Josie had fainted during the shooting. She had a cut on her forehead, decorated with a butterfly bandage, and a mild concussion. The doctors wanted to keep her overnight for observation, to be safe. Safe had a whole new definition now. Alex had also learned, from the unending news coverage, the names of the dead, one of whom was Matthew Royston. Matt. What if Josie had been with her boyfriend when he was shot? Josie had been unconscious the whole time Alex had been here. She was small and still under the faded hospital sheets. The tie at the neck of her hospital Johnny had come unraveled. From time to time, her right hand twitched. Alex reached out now and grasped it. Wake up, she thought. Prove to me you're okay. What if Alex hadn't been late to work that morning? Might she have stayed at the kitchen table with Josie, talking about the things she imagined mothers and daughters discussed, but that she never seemed to have the time to? What if she'd taken a better look at Josie when she hurried downstairs, told her to go back to bed and get some rest? What if she'd taken Josie on a spur-of-the-moment trip to Punta Cana, San Diego, Fiji, all the places Alex dream-surfed on her computer in chambers and thought about visiting, but never did? What if she'd been a prescient enough mother to keep her daughter home from school today? There were, of course, hundreds of other parents who'd made the same honest mistake she had, but that was shallow comfort to Alex. None of their children were Josie. None of them, surely, had as much to lose as she did.
When this is over, Alex promised silently, we will go to the rainforest, or the pyramids, or a beach as white as bone. We will eat grapes from the vine. We will swim with sea turtles. We will walk miles on cobblestone streets. We will laugh and talk and confess. We will.
At the same time, a small voice in her head was scheduling this paradise. After, it said, because first, this trial will come to your courtroom. It was true. A case like this would be fast-tracked to the docket. Alex was the Superior Court judge for Grafton County, and would be for the next 8 months. Although Josie had been at the scene of the crime, She wasn't technically a victim of the shooter. Had Josie been wounded, Alex would have automatically been removed from the case. But as it stood, there was no legal conflict in Alex's sitting as judge, as long as she could separate her personal feelings as the mother of a high school student from her professional feelings as a justice. This would be her first big trial as a Superior Court judge, the one that set a tone for the rest of her tenure on the bench. Not that she was really thinking about that now. Suddenly, Josie stirred. Alex watched consciousness pour into her, reach a high water mark.
"Where am I?"
Alex combed her fingers through her daughter's hair.
"In the hospital." "Why?"
Her hand stilled. "Do you remember anything about today?"
"Matt came over before school," Josie said,
and then she pushed herself upright.
"Was there, like, a car accident?"
Alex hesitated, unsure of what she was supposed to say. Wasn't Josie better off not knowing the truth? What if this was the way her mind was protecting her from whatever she'd witnessed?
"You're fine," Alex said carefully. "You weren't hurt."
Josie turned to her, relieved.
"What about Matt?"
Lewis was getting a lawyer. Lacey held that nugget of information to her chest like a hot stone as she rocked back and forth on her bed and waited for Peter to come home.
"It's going to be all right,"
Lewis had promised, although she didn't understand how he could make so specious a statement.
"Clearly this is a mistake,"
Lewis had said, but he hadn't been down at the high school. He hadn't seen the faces of the students, kids who would never really be kids again. There was a part of Lacey that wanted so badly to believe Lewis, to think that somehow this broken thing might be fixed. But there was another part of her that remembered him waking Peter at 4 a.m. to go out and sit in a duck blind. Lewis had taught his son how to hunt, never expecting that Peter might find a different kind of prey. Lacey understood hunting as both a sport and an evolutionary claim. She even knew how to make an excellent venison stew and teriyaki goose and enjoyed whatever meal Lewis's hobby put on the table. But right now, she thought,
it is his fault,
because then it couldn't be hers. How could you change a boy's bedding every week and feed him breakfast and drive him to the orthodontist and not know him at all? She'd assumed that if Peter's answers were monosyllabic, it was just because of his age, that any mother would have made the same assumption. Lacey combed through her memories for some red flag, some conversation she might have misread, something overlooked. But all she could recall were 1,000 ordinary moments. 1,000 ordinary moments that some mothers would never get to have again with their own children. Tears sprang to her eyes. She wiped them with the back of her hand.
"Don't think about them,"
she silently scolded.
"Right now you have to worry about yourself."
Had Peter been thinking that too? Swallowing, Lacey walked into her son's room. It was dark, the bed neatly made just as Lacey had left it this morning. But now she saw the poster of a band called Death Wish on the wall and wondered why a boy might hang it up. She opened the closet and saw the empty bottles and electrical tape and torn rags and everything else she had missed the first time around. Suddenly, Lacey stopped. She could fix this herself. She could fix this for both of them. She ran downstairs to the kitchen and ripped 3 large black 33-gallon trash bags free from their coil before hurrying back to Peter's room. She started in the closet, shoving packages of shoelaces, sugar, potassium nitrate fertilizer, and, my God, were these pipes? Into the first bag. She didn't have a plan about what she would do with all these things,
but she would get them out of her house. When the doorbell rang, Lacey sighed with relief, expecting Lewis, although if she had been thinking clearly, she would have realized that Lewis would have simply let himself in. She abandoned her hall and went downstairs to find a policeman holding a slim blue folder.
"Mrs. Houghton," the officer said. What could they possibly want? They already had her son. "We've got a search warrant."
He handed her the paperwork and pushed past her, followed by five other policemen.
"Jackson and Walhorn, you head up to the boys' room. Rodriguez, the basement. Tews and Gilchrist, start with the first floor. And everyone, let's make sure you cover the answering machines and all computer equipment."
Then he noticed Lacey still standing there, stricken.
"Mrs. Houghton, you'll have to leave the premises."
The policeman escorted her to her own front hallway. Numb, Lacey followed. What would they think when they reached Peter's room and found that trash bag? Would they blame Peter, or Lacey, for enabling him? Did they already? A rush of cold air hit Lacey in the face as the front door opened.
"For how long?"
The officer shrugged.
"Till we're done,"
he said, and he left her out in the cold.
Jordan McAfee had been an attorney for nearly 20 years and truly believed he had seen and heard it all until now, when he and his wife, Selena, stood in front of the television set watching CNN's coverage of the school shooting at Sterling High.
"It's like Columbine," Selena said. "In our backyard."
"Except right now," Jordan murmured. "There's someone to blame who's still alive."
He glanced down at the baby in his wife's arms, a blue-eyed, coffee-colored mixture of his own wasp jeans and Selena's never-ending limbs and ebony skin, and he reached for the remote to turn down the volume, just in case his son was taking any of this in subconsciously. Jordan knew Sterling High. It was just down the street from his barber, and two blocks away from the room over the bank he rented as his law office. He had represented a few students who'd been busted with pot in their glove compartments or who got caught drinking underage at the college in town. Selena, who wasn't only his wife but also his investigator, had gone into the school to talk to kids from time to time about a case. They hadn't lived here very long. His son, Thomas, the only good thing to come out of his lousy first marriage, graduated from high school in Salem Falls and was now a sophomore at Yale, where Jordan spent $40,000 a year to hear that he had narrowed down his career plans to becoming either a performance artist, an art historian, or a professional clown. Jordan had finally asked Selena to marry him, and after she'd gotten pregnant, they moved to Sterling, because the school district had such a good reputation. Go figure. When the telephone rang and Jordan, who didn't want to watch the coverage but couldn't tear his eyes away from it either, made no motion to answer it, Selena dumped the baby in his arms and reached for the receiver.
"Hey," she said. "How's it going?"
Jordan glanced up and raised his brows.
"Thomas," Selena mouthed.
"Yeah, hang on, he's right here." He took the phone from Selena.
"What the hell is going on?"
Thomas asked.
"Sterling High is all over MSNBC.com.
"I don't know any more than you do," Jordan said. "It's pandemonium."
"I know some kids there. We competed against them in track and field. It's just, it's not real."
Jordan could still hear ambulance sirens in the distance.
"It's real," he said.
There was a click on the line. "Call waiting." "Hang on, I have to take this."
"Is this Mr. McAfee?"
"Yes."
I understand that you're an attorney. I got your name from Stuart McBride over at Sterling College."
On the television, a list of the names of the known dead began to scroll. with yearbook pictures. "You know, I'm on the other line," Jordan said. "Could I take down your name and number and get back to you?"
"I was wondering if you'd represent my son," the caller said. "He's the boy who... the one from the high school who..."
The voice stumbled and then broke.
"They say my son's the one who did it."
Jordan thought of the last time he'd represented a teenage boy. Like this one, Chris Hart had been found holding a smoking gun.
Will you take his case?"
Jordan forgot about Thomas, waiting. He forgot about Chris Hart and how the case had nearly turned him inside out. Instead, he looked at Selena and the baby in her arms. Sam twisted, grabbing at her earring. This boy, the one who had walked into Sterling High this morning and committed a massacre, was someone's son. And in spite of a town that would be reeling for years and media coverage that had already reached the point of saturation, he deserved a fair trial.
"Yes," Jordan said. "I will."
Finally, after the bomb squad had dismantled the pipe bomb in Peter Houghton's car, after 116 shell casings had been found scattered in the school from fired bullets, after the accident recon guys had begun to measure the evidence and the location of the bodies so that they could produce a scale diagram of the scene, after the crime techs had taken the first of hundreds of snapshots that they would put into indexed photo books, Patrick called everyone together into the auditorium of the school and stood on the stage in the near darkness.
"What we have is a massive amount of information," he told the crowd assembled before him. "There's going to be a lot of pressure on us to do this fast and to do this right. I want everyone back here in 24 hours so that we can see where we're at."
People began to disperse. At the next meeting, Patrick would be given the completed photo books, all evidence not being sent to the lab, and all lab submissions. In 24 hours, he'd be buried so far underneath the avalanche he wouldn't know which way was up. While the others headed back to various parts of the building to complete the work that would take them all night and the next day, Patrick walked out to his car. It had stopped raining. Patrick planned to go back to the station to review the evidence that had been seized from the Houghtons' home, and he wanted to talk to the parents, if they were still willing. But he found himself pointing his car instead toward the medical center, and he pulled into the parking lot. He walked into the emergency entrance and flashed his badge.
"Look," he said to the nurse, "I know you had a lot of kids come through here today. But one of the first was a girl named Josie. I'm trying to find her."
The nurse fluttered her hands over her computer keyboard.
"Josie who?"
"That's the thing," Patrick admitted. "I don't know."
The screen swam with a flurry of information, and the nurse tapped her finger against the glass.
"Cormier. She's up on the fourth floor, room 422.
Patrick thanked her and took the elevator upstairs.
Cormier. The name sounded familiar, but he couldn't quite place it.
It was common enough, he figured. Maybe he'd read it in the paper or seen it on a television show. He slipped past the nurse's desk and followed the numbers down the hall. The door to Josie's room was ajar. The girl sat up in bed, wrapped in shadows, talking to a figure that stood beside her. Patrick knocked softly and stepped into the room. Josie stared at him blankly. The woman beside her turned around.
"Cormier," Patrick realized. "As in Judge Cormier."
He'd been called to testify in her courtroom a few times before she became a Superior Court judge. He'd gone to her for warrants as a last resort. After all, she came from a public defender's background, which in Patrick's mind meant that even if she now was scrupulously fair, she still had once played for the other side.
"Your Honor," he said, "I didn't realize Josie was your daughter."
He approached the bed.
"How are you doing?"
Josie stared at him.
Do I know you?
I'm the one who carried you out.
He stopped as the judge put her hand on his arm and drew him out of Josie's range of hearing.
She doesn't remember anything that happened, the judge whispered. She thinks for some reason that she was in a car accident. And I...
Her voice trailed off.
I haven't been able to tell her the truth.
Patrick understood. When you loved someone, you didn't want to be the one who brought their world crashing down.
Would you like me to do it?
The judge hesitated and then nodded gratefully. Patrick faced Josie again.
You all right?
My head hurts. The doctors said I have a concussion and have to stay overnight.
She looked up at him.
I guess I ought to thank you for rescuing me.
Suddenly, a flicker of intention crossed her face.
Do you know what happened to Matt? The guy who was in the car with me?
Patrick sat down on the edge of the hospital bed.
Josie, he said gently, you weren't in a car accident. There was an incident at your school. A student came in and started shooting people.
Josie shook her head, trying to dislodge the words.
Matt was one of the victims.
Her eyes filled with tears.
Is he okay?
Patrick looked down at the soft waffle weave of the blanket between them.
I'm sorry.
No,
Josie said.
No, you're lying to me.
She struck out at Patrick, clipping him across the face and chest. The judge rushed forward, trying to hold her daughter back, but Josie was wild, shrieking, crying, clawing, drawing the attention of the nursing staff down the hall. Two of them flew into the room on white wings, shooing out Patrick and Judge Cormier, while they administered a sedative to Josie. In the hallway, Patrick leaned against the wall and closed his eyes.
Jesus Christ. Was this what he'd have to put every one of his witnesses through?
He was about to apologize to the judge for upsetting Josie when she turned on him just like her daughter had.
What the hell do you think you're doing telling her about Matt?
You asked me to,
Patrick bristled.
To tell her about the school, the judge qualified. Not to tell her her boyfriend's dead.
You know damn well Josie would have found out sooner or...
Later,
the judge interrupted.
Much later.
The nurses appeared in the doorway.
She's sleeping now,
one of them whispered.
We'll be back in to check on her.
They both waited until the nurses were out of hearing range.
Look, Patrick said tightly. Today I saw kids who'd been shot in the head, kids who will never walk again, kids who died because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Your daughter, she's in shock, but she's one of the lucky ones.
His words hit her, a solid slap. For just a moment, when Patrick looked at the judge, she no longer seemed furious. Her gray eyes were heavy with all the scenarios that, thankfully, had not come to pass. Her mouth softened with relief. And then, just as suddenly, her features smoothed, impassive.
I'm sorry. I'm not usually like this. It's just been a really awful day.
Patrick tried, but he could see no trace left of the emotion that had, for a moment, broken her.
Seamless. That's what she was.
I know you were only trying to do your job, the judge said.
I would like to talk to Josie, but that's not why I came. I'm here because she was the first one. Well, I just needed to know she was all right.
He offered Judge Cormier the smallest of smiles, the kind that can start a heart to breaking.
Take care of her,
Patrick said. And then he turned and walked down the hall, aware of the heat of her gaze on his back, and how much it felt like the touch of a hand.
12 years before. On his first day of kindergarten, Peter Houghton woke up at 4:32 a.m. He padded into his parents' room and asked if it was time yet to take the school bus. For as long as he could remember, he had watched his brother Joey get on the bus, and it was a mystery of dynamic proportion, the way the sun bounced off its snub yellow nose, the door that hinged like the jaw of a dragon, the dramatic sigh when it came to a stop. Peter had a matchbox car that looked just like the bus Joey rode on twice a day, the same bus that now he was going to get to ride on, too. His mother told him to go back to sleep until it was morning, but he couldn't. Instead, he got dressed in the special clothes his mother had bought for his first day of school, and he lay back down in bed to wait. He was the first one downstairs for breakfast, and his mother made chocolate chip pancakes, his favorite. She kissed him on the cheek and took a picture of him sitting at the breakfast table, and then another one when he was dressed in his coat and had his empty knapsack on his back, like the shell of a turtle.
"I can't believe my baby is going to school," his mother said.
Joey, who was in first grade this year, told him to stop acting stupid.
"It's just school," he said. "Big deal."
Peter's mother finished buttoning his coat.
"It was a big deal to you once, too," she said.
Then she told Peter she had a surprise for him. She went into the kitchen and reappeared with a Superman lunchbox. Superman was reaching forward, as if he were trying to break out of the metal. His whole body stuck out from the background the tiniest bit, like the letters on books blind people read. Peter liked thinking that even if he couldn't see, he would be able to tell that this was his lunchbox. He took it from his mother and hugged her. He heard the thud of a piece of fruit rolling, the crinkle of wax paper, and he imagined the insides of his lunch like mysterious organs. They waited at the end of the driveway, and just as Peter had dreamed over and over, the yellow bus rose over the crest of the hill. "One more," his mother called, and she took a picture of Peter with the bus groaning to a stop behind him. "Joey," she instructed, "take care of your brother." Then she kissed Peter on the forehead. "My big boy," she said, and her mouth pinched tight, the way it did when she was trying not to cry. Suddenly, Peter felt his stomach turn to ice. What if kindergarten was not as great as he had imagined? What if his teacher looked like the witch on that TV program that gave him nightmares sometimes? What if he forgot which direction the letter E went and everyone made fun of him? With hesitation, he climbed the steps of the school bus. The driver wore an army jacket and had two teeth missing in the front.
"There's seats in the back," he said,
and Peter headed down the aisle, looking for Joey. His brother was sitting next to a boy Peter didn't know. Joey glanced at him as he walked by, but didn't say anything.
"Peter!"
He turned and saw Josie patting the empty seat next to her. She had her dark hair in pigtails and was wearing a skirt, even though she hated skirts.
"I saved it for you," Josie said.
He sat down next to her, feeling better already. He was riding inside a bus. And he was sitting next to his best friend in the whole world.
"Cool lunchbox," Josie said.
He held it up to show her the way that you could make Superman look like he was moving if you wiggled it, and just then a hand reached across the aisle. A boy with ape arms and a backward baseball cap grabbed the lunchbox out of Peter's grasp.
"Hey, freak," he said. "You want to see Superman fly?"
Before Peter understood what the older boy was doing, he opened a window and hurled Peter's lunchbox out of it. Peter stood up, craning his neck around to see out the rear emergency door. His lunchbox burst open on the asphalt. His apple rolled across the dotted yellow line of the road and vanished beneath the tire of an oncoming car.
Sit down,
the bus driver yelled. Peter sank back into his seat. His face felt cold, but his ears were burning.